Hello and welcome to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, and this is my colleague and co-host, Sam Wong.
Hi there, Sam Wong, professor of neuroscience and founder of the Princeton Election Consortium.
The history of anti-Semitism is a subject that has received scholarly attention for some time, but recently it's been gaining renewed interest, not just in the academy, but more broadly. Part of this has to do with the context globally of rising incidents of anti-Semitic rhetoric and violence throughout parts of Europe, here in the United States as well. And one of the periods that has always been central to our understanding of this phenomenon dates back to the late 19th and early 20th century in Eastern Europe, where pogroms against Jews who were living there devastated the community, set into motion all kinds of migration throughout the world, and created something of the foundation for the Holocaust that would take place during the 1940s. They were also international events, in part as a result of the migration of people that would happen and the international diaspora of Judaism that was taking form during that period, watching all of this unfold. Today, our guest to discuss some of this is Steven Zipperstein, who's the author of a wonderful new book, Pogrom, Kishinev, and the Tilt of History, which was published by Liverlight just recently. Professor Zipperstein is the Daniel Koshland Professor in Jewish Culture and History at Stanford University. He's the author and editor of 8 books, including The Jews of Odessa, An Elusive Prophet, An Imagining Russian Jewry, and much more. One of his books was shortlisted for the National Jewish Book Award in Biography, Autobiography, and Memoir. He's been awarded the Leviant Prize of the Modern Language Association, the Judah Magnus Gold Medal, the American Friends of the Hebrew University, and the Koret Prize for Outstanding Contributions to the American Jewish Community. He's also published widely outside of academic realms in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, the New Republic, and much, much more. He's also the co-editor of the Yale University Press Leon Black Foundation Jewish Lives series. So, Professor Zipperstein, welcome to our show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Maybe you can start by just telling our listeners a bit more about the broader context in the early 20th century in terms of what was happening in the Russian Empire. You're right, this trend about the pogroms solidified as anti-Jewish attacks crisscrossed Russia amid the 1905-1906 constitutional crisis, in which 800 were killed. Such massacres were frequently the work of roving bands of Jew haters, the so-called Black Hundreds, whose commitment to saving Russia from constitutional rule was translated into anti-Jewish brutality. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about what was going on in this period.
The conflation of pogrom and the Jews of the Russian Empire, the largest concentration of Jews in the world at the time, fully half the Jews in the world live in the Russian Empire at the turn of the 20th century. This conflation is both understandable and a distortion. And it's understandable because of the violence that you describe, violence aimed at Jews during periods of uncertainty and unrest, and violence that is seen at the time as signaling for many Jews the inconceivability of continuing to live in Russia, which then contributes toward the mass immigration of Jews to the United States, to England, South Africa, to some extent to Palestine, South America. On the other hand, there's so much else that's happening in this community, and it's the birthplace of essentially every Jewish modern ideology of Zionism, of Jewish socialism, of Yiddishism, of modern Hebrew literature. arguably even Esperanto, the effort to create an international language, a joke that was popular at the time, is what language do you speak at an Esperanto conference? And the answer is Yiddish, because the founder of Esperanto and nearly all the constituency eager to enter into the larger world were Jews. And so on the one hand, there is this violence, and violence is at the epicenter of the new book that I've written. But at the same time, so much of what I've tried to demonstrate is the interplay between the history of violence and the mythologies built around the violence, and I suspect we'll turn to that later on. So this is a community of some 6 million Jews, most of them poor, concentrated in craft work, mostly in the northern areas where Jews are living in the so-called Pale of Settlement, the western provinces of the Russian Empire, concentrated overwhelmingly in trade in the southern provinces, and who begin to emigrate in large numbers in the 1880s and 1890s, not primarily because of pogroms. They begin to emigrate because of terrible economic conditions in large slices of the Pale, and the allure, especially of America, because of push and pull factors. There happens to be as much internal immigration from regions where Jews are living in that experienced no pogroms to the areas where pogroms had broken out in the 1880s, as there is external migration from the Russian Empire elsewhere. And so, just to complicate the scenario, on the other hand, what pogrom comes to mean, I think, for large numbers of Russian Jews, whether they've experienced the violence or not, is the inconceivability of continuing to live in the empire. And there is the belief that the Russian Empire is responsible for these attacks. It turns out to be a false belief. The Russian government, as much as it distrusts Jews, is far more fearful of unrest in its own cities, villages, and countryside. But there is the understandable and justified sense that Jews are seen by the Russian government and by large swaths of the population as distrustful, as economically rapacious, increasingly as politically unreliable, as inclined toward political radicalism. And then you have an attack like the one that occurs in Kishinev at the cusp of a new century, at a time when it seems it's believed that things will get better, that Russia is moving in some ways toward the West, and consequently it's all the more shocking.
And you said just now that some of the perception of the relationship of the Russian government to episodes of violence was important to considerations of why the community could not sustain itself there, but it wasn't always based on accurate information. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, there is the deep, widespread belief, and a belief that ends up being given what seems to be empirical proof in the wake of the Kishinev pogrom of 1903, that turns out to be, as I argue in the book, in many ways the seminal event of late imperial Russian Jewish history. There's the deep belief on the part of Jews that the Russian government is responsible, that nothing can happen on the streets of Russia without the Russian government's involvement. There's, in general, an exaggerated notion of the power of the Russian government that helps solidify the power of the Russian government. As it turns out, as we know in retrospect, there are fewer police employed in Russia per person than there are in France at the same period. And so there's a disjuncture useful to the government and its stability between the belief that the government is powerful and the reality. And in the wake of the Kishinev pogrom, which in its intensity really lasts about a day and a half, with the greatest violence occurring, as I show in my book, on six or seven streets, really alleyways, over the course of about 3 or 4 hours, and with these streets being the best known sites in all of Russian Jewry, what appears is a letter with under the signature of the then Minister of Interior, Pleve, essentially acknowledging that the pogrom was planned by the central government, by the imperial government. It turns out the letter was a forgery, but it was widely believed.
Is it known where the letter came from?
We don't know. We don't know. It was probably written by either Jews, Jewish radicals, well-meaning non-Jewish radicals, and no doubt written with sincerity, with the belief that if actually Pleve could be sat down and asked his real views and what he really was doing behind the scenes, this is what he would say and this is what he would do. And there was so much about imperial Russian politics that felt as if it was going on behind a screen. And so the authors of this letter were giving voice to what they were convinced was reality. The letter itself had an enormous impact. It
shaped the story. It shaped the international story of what had happened.
It shaped the international story. It actually contributes toward the successfully to the argument that there should be relatively unrestricted Jewish immigration from Russia. At the same time, in 1902, there's a confirmation of restricted immigration against the Chinese. And it really does shape the story inordinately for Jews and others. And as I demonstrate in the book, vastly dissimilar in content, but typologically similar in its origin, is another forgery, far more famous, that spills from the pogrom, and that is the first version of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion.
Okay, now because, we get to the instigator. So, you know, in terms of causes, there's this figure in your book who figures prominently. Krushevan, right?
Krushevan, yeah. Yes.
Actually, you know, before we get to that, I wonder if I could ask you just a little bit more about the weakness of the police at that time, if you don't mind. It seems that an alternative version of this is that the police were in fact weak, because you write in there about looters breaking into the safe of a Jewish shopkeeper and taking 4 hours to do it, and the police don't do anything. And so, right. Is it possible that maybe rather than the imperial government being this powerful distant force, as you say, they don't have that many policemen, maybe there's some kind of local energy behind this pogrom, and what they're doing is they're just standing out of the way. Now, is it out of malevolence, or is it out of inability to stop a thing that's happening?
There's certainly malevolence at work. There's indifference at work, the interplay between malevolence and indifference. And Jews rightly understand indifference as malevolence. There's the small number of police. There's the utter inefficiency of the local governor general, who's not particularly anti-Semitic, at least by Russian standards.
Is this the guy who throws parties with his mistress, that guy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know. Yeah. And
charming.
So, I mean, I do suggest in the book that it's well known at the time that constraints that would otherwise constrain people elsewhere in the empire simply aren't as powerful.
But you also say that. But you also say that Kishinev is like at one point you say the town is about one third Jewish. So these are communities that are living together. You paint a picture of a diverse community with lots of ethnicities all together, and the Jews are getting along. So this really is a strikingly bizarre event that a third of the population would be targeted by this violence.
Yeah, I mean, targeted by about 900 people in a population of some 110,000, and with a whole array, vast array of reactions on the part of non-Jews. I mean, as I describe in the book, on the one hand, there seems to be, much as Young Gross described, neighbors, an interplay between familiarity and ferocity, where sometimes the most ferocious attacks are those of neighbors against neighbors. On the other hand, Jews trust non-Jews sufficiently to take for granted in the middle of the attacks that they could simply run into the house of a non-Jew, which happens with frequency, according to the transcripts that I've read, and be saved. And it is true that in an atmosphere where Jews are seen widely as economically rapacious during an economic downturn that occurs in the wake of a bad crop period in 1902, in an atmosphere where there's it's a city with some of the most ferociously devoted far-right anti-Semites in the empire, and a lax local government and an inefficient governor general. All of these are factors that contribute to the outbreak of the pogrom. The pogrom itself, there are other attacks, as I point out in the book, more ferocious attacks, certainly in 1905, 1906. There are 600 Jews who were killed on the streets of Odessa in October 1905. But this does not become a canonized event in the way in which Kishinev certainly does. So much of Kishinev's infamy has to do with the location of the city, the way in which the news about Kishinev spreads. I would argue also the fact that that at the outset, 45 Jews are killed. Another four die from wounds incurred during the attacks. And you could actually, and photography is used extensively for the first time to report a Jewish calamity in the international press. So you could actually picture all the Jews dead in one photograph, which is done with frequency. Photographs that are reprinted throughout the Western world. And this, in some ways, the interplay between the relatively small number of Jews killed and the impact of the pogrom, I think, is very real.
Now, before we get to both how this was reported and how it was received by other groups, could you just talk a little bit about what the trigger was for the actual violence, how it unfolded, and as you just mentioned, the connection with the protocols of the Elders of Zion. How did these all fit together?
Yeah, the protocols end up being published a little bit later, and I'll turn to that in a moment. But the riot starts much as various other relatively innocent, if unsettling, incidents happen in and around the time of Easter. And so there were rumors of something more intense. And we know that from the way in which at least some Jews prepared before the attack, which occurs at the very tail end of the Jewish Passover festival and at the beginning of Easter. But it begins with youngsters throwing rocks at Jewish windows, which apparently was something of an annual event in Kishinev and elsewhere. And seems relatively innocent. The police are aware that there's the possibility of inebriated locals acting out on Easter, and there are somewhat more police on the streets than usual. And then it accelerates. It accelerates on the first day of the attack. And here the accounts differ. It accelerates immensely on the second day. The first day, there's no Jew killed. There seem to have been a good many Jewish girls and women raped, especially in the night of the first day. There are soldiers stationed nearby, a large number of soldiers. But as is well known to Russian historians, the military resents being involved in any kind of in putting down civil disorder. And the governor general, perhaps for this reason, perhaps because of reasons of laxity, it's simply unclear, only calls them in on the afternoon of the second day, and they're able to put down the riot very quickly within the span of a couple hours. What seems to have happened and distinguished this particular case is the existence of a clutch of 10, 12, maybe more, fervid anti-Semites who have been plotting this attack for some time, connected with a newspaper, Besarabitz, which is owned and operated by Pavel Krushevan, who is at the time one of a small number of the most famous anti-Semites in the Russian Empire. And there's a term that's widely used in Russian at the time called a respectable anti-Semite. you could be a respectable anti-Semite, and Khrushchev sort of hugs the boundary of respectability and non-respectability. A very well-known writer at the time, a widely published novelist, and the owner of the only real newspaper in the region, and a newspaper that has been whipping up anti-Jewish hatred, especially fiercely for the month or two before the pogrom, partly based on the accusation that Jews have been engaged in a ritual murder, the killing of a Christian child, to use his blood for Passover purposes, and it's demonstrated by the police that the ritual murder hasn't happened, but still the rumor persists. And so the existence of this small organized group of anti-Semites, their impact, it seems, on seminary students, the local seminary is a center of both far-left and far-right political activity. The fact that these attacks on Jews have occurred annually all contribute toward blowing things up. And then, this is one of the more curious aspects of the events, on early morning on the second day of the pogrom, about 200, maybe 300 Jews organized themselves to attack their attackers. And they're stopped by the police. Eventually, a number of them are jailed. But the rumor spreads that Gentiles were simply engaging in holiday-like activities on the first day and then simply had to defend themselves because of ferocious Jews who were attacking them. And this ends up justifying the accelerated violence on the second day.
Maybe mass rape is a holiday-like activity.
Right. Yeah. And we have no idea really how many rapes occurred. Rapes invariably are underreported. There were at least 40, probably many more unmarried Jewish women are disinclined to actually report rapes because it makes them unmarriageable. And married women are disinclined because not infrequently, and this occurs in a Kishinev, we have evidence of this, husbands then move to divorce wives.
And you had some the research on this. I just wanted to turn to that for a second. I'm sure was difficult from the events to Khrushchev himself. How did you gather some of the material for this story?
So toward the end of writing, and this is of course a blessing and a curse, as both of you know as scholars, I discovered in private hands an extraordinary cache of papers that had never been used before for the writing of history produced by Khrushchev. And it was quite by accident. I was actually in Boston on my way to Moldova for just to walk around the town and be able to concretize it for the book, and had heard through through the grapevine of those of us interested in the origins of the protocols that there was a Moldovan Jewish journalist in Brookline, just down the street from Fenway, who had stuff. And I called him and spent a couple hours with him and his wife, and he took down from his shelf this extraordinary, small but immensely valuable archive.
And this is the diary. The diary's in there?
Well, the diaries were included in it. I'll describe it in a minute. So he takes down from his shelf this archive, which he had acquired. He had written a history of a psychiatric hospital at the edge of Chisinau, as Chisinau is now called. And either one of the inmates was a nephew of Khrushchev's, and either the nephew himself or the director, I'm not sure I ever got the story entirely straight, gave him these papers, gave to this Jewish journalist these papers that seem to have been Khrushchev's most sensitive papers. He dies young at the age of 49 of cancer. The nephew is then 15. He's a great admirer of Khrushchev, who had served as a surrogate father. Khrushchev had never married. Now, Khrushchev today is one of the great emblems of what's called Christian socialism. It's really anti-capitalism, anti-globalism, anti-Semitism, homophobia. In
so he's the Steve Bannon of Steve Bannon of Bessarabia.
In Bessarabia, they're even worse than Steve Bannon.
All right. Well, I'm just saying, you know, he seems familiar. I'm just saying he seems familiar.
Yeah. Alas, familiar. And so it turns out, as soon as I started looking at the material, there was, for example, his diary, Khrushchev's diary from the age of 15 or 16. And he declares in the diary that he's in some vivid detail that he's having sex with a Cossack, and Cossacks tend to come in only one gender, and he wishes he was born a lady, and his
Krasavitsa, you say, the beautiful one,
the beautiful one, is how he describes his lover, and it's the in this archive, Khrushchev at the time of the Kishinev pogrom is seen as perhaps the or one of the most powerful anti-Semites in the world, closely connected with the Russian government. He received at least one large subsidy from the Russian government for one of his works. It turns out he's bankrupt. There are bailiff accounts of sequestering, taking away his property. I have information about the wood that his bookshelves are made out of, his table, assessments of the value of his printing presses, and it's just a sort of historical material that, you know, so much of it, if I'd written this book as a novel and brought it to the fiction editor at my press rather than the nonfiction editor, they would have said, no, this is not how life works, it's impossible. It turns out that it's almost certain that his mother dies very young, and his father remarries, and it seems almost certain that he remarries a Jew who presumably converts, and his mother dies when Khrushchev is, I think, only two or three, so he's raised by a Jew. His sister runs off to the United States with a Jew and is interviewed in the 1930s with her head covered. She's an Orthodox Jewess in Baltimore. Something that you would be told would be inconceivable in a novel. It would be absurd. And yet, this is life.
But I have to pause here. So you found this trove of papers, the personal papers of the guy who mm-hmm. instigated the first pogrom, the guy who wrote the protocols to the elders of Zion. You found him from this 85-year-old dude living near Fenway Park. And then you took those papers, and I just have to pause and get away from the history for a moment. You sent all those papers by FedEx. Now, did you photocopy those before you send them, or did you just stick them in a FedEx box? I'm having trouble following.
What you do when you find the personal papers of the publisher and the likely author or co-author of the first version of the protocols is unclear.
I would not let them out of my sight. I would like handcuff them to myself so I could use them.
The problem is I was leaving the next morning for the next day from Moldova.
Okay.
And what was I to do with them?
Right.
And to carry them with me to Moldova and to leave them in Boston. So I happened to be staying in a good hotel, and I figured valuables had been left sometimes in that hotel, and they had shipped them to their owners. And I went to the concierge and asked, and he said, "There's a particularly reliable FedEx. I don't know if some FedExes are unreliable."
And I'm glad you didn't find out.
Yeah, I didn't find out, and you know, called my assistant at Stanford and said, "Please lock this away at my office as soon as you receive it." And it arrived, and eventually I sold it. For that Moldovan Jewish journalist to the Hoover, and it's now being cataloged, being organized at the Hoover and institution at Stanford. So, yeah, I whether that was the wisest decision or not, I don't. I'll probably never know. You're right to question it.
Well, all right. Well, we'll move beyond your handling of the archives, but we're very. It's an impressive find. I mean, that's the kind of. Not only is it the story that's incredible, it's the kind of finding of documents that you hear about but never imagine really happens. But one of the really interesting parts of the book is not simply the events, but how they are both covered by the press all around the world, and how international organizations, not simply Jewish organizations react to this. Can you walk us through a little bit first of the press coverage? You mentioned photography and how there were images. How else does the media pick up on what's going on? How do they report on it?
So the first part of the story has to do with the speed with which the news of the events reaches the Western world. And that has a lot to do with where Chisinau is located, not far from the Romanian border being the most porous of all borders in Imperial Russia, with the most bribable of all authorities on both sides. And as it happens, probably for these reasons, the location in Chisinau of the so-called Correspondence Bureau of the Zionist Movement, headed for a long time by a man named Jacob Bernstein Kogan, who, as it happens, was at school with Khrushchev. They were in uniform at the same time. And probably Jacob Bernstein Kogan is a massive, portly man who is a doctor but never manages to make a living from medicine, which is not a highly paid profession in the way that it comes to be eventually in the United States. His great moment in history is the way in which on the second night of the pogrom, he collects a large sum of money from the local rich. He then has all these international contacts because he's been the conduit of Zionist information to the West and elsewhere. And he's in touch with smugglers, and one or another of these smugglers smuggle news about the pogrom across the border at Yassi and transmit it to the West. The initial news about the pogrom from the Times in London and elsewhere is from Jacob Bernstein Kogan. I've seen the telegrams. And so part of the story has to do with just the contingency, the location of Chisinau as a site of the riot. Had the same events, I'm convinced, occurred 200 miles to the east, it would never have become the Chisinau pogrom. So the news spreads very quickly, which is part of the reason why local anti-Semites feel that this substantiates their sense that Jews control the international media and much else. As soon as the news hits the Lower East Side in particular, where there is now a very large, dense, highly politicized Jewish community with an organ at their disposal, the Yiddish Vorwort, which at the time is little more than a fact sheet for the Socialist Party, but edited by Abraham Kahan, who had left the paper and now has returned to it. This news both galvanizes the Lower East Side profoundly, but also it's an event that the Lower East Side can take on its own that isn't political. It's a matter of relief. It's philanthropy. It's something that cuts across political lines, and they're the ones who initially champion it and eventually push the mostly German Jewish-born American leadership, or at least people whose parents were German, into responding to it. But at the same time, a crucial ingredient, as you rightly say, beyond the Jewish community, is Hearst. So Hearst, and think about the similarities. I mean, you compared Khrushchev to Steve Bannon. I think a closer comparison in my story is between Hearst and the man who is now our president. He's massively rich. He's already in Congress. He's hoping to run either for the Democratic Party for the presidency, or at least for the governorship of New York. He's courting Jews in New York who are now numerous. He edits newspapers that are little different at the time for the National Enquirer, and the Chisinau pogrom really is the first international event that he reports on with any consistency. And he hires to report on the event Michael Davitt, who at the time is a well-known Irish radical who makes his money mostly from speaking and journalism. And soon after the pogrom ends, Davitt goes to Chisinau, and he's a splendid writer. He writes a whole series of articles that are reprinted throughout the world, and then writes the first best-selling book in any Western language about the Jews of Russia. And he becomes a folk hero. I've found plays in Yiddish about him, plays in English about him, written for Broadway. There's Yiddish poetry written about Michael David. Michael David becomes a folk hero. So you have not only the institutionalization of the Kishinev pogrom in the memory of Zionists, Jewish socialists, and others, but you have these texts that of enormous import. David's book on the Kishinev pogrom, and then for Jews, even more powerfully, Chaim Nachman Bialik's In the City of Killing, which he publishes a few months after the pogrom, which really it's the most influential of all Jewish poems in modernity, and it becomes a crucial part of the Jewish-Palestinian, eventually the Israeli school curriculum. It becomes the source of fundamental information about what it's like to live in exile and to be beaten by Jews, by non-Jews, I'm sorry, in exile, and how Jews need to rebuild themselves in Zion. So you have ideological consolidation, textual consolidation, newspaper reports. Kishinev is at the front, at the front banner of Western newspapers for weeks, and in the Yiddish press for months.
And the other connection our listeners would be interested in and would not probably expect is the connection and the thread that leads us to the civil rights movement here in the United States with the formation of the NAACP. Can you tell us about that connection?
That was a big surprise to me, and I devote the last chapter of the book to that. The impact of the pogrom on the American public, then President Theodore Roosevelt speaking out about the pogrom as one of the most horrendous events he knows of, and an event that has precipitated the greatest outcry of any that he could think of in American history. This prompts, quite understandably, much of the African-American press, especially the African-American press that isn't controlled or funded by Booker T. Washington, to raise questions, sometimes very sharply, about why it is that the American public has responded so vigorously to pogroms in Russia and has responded so weakly to lynching in the United States. And the Socialist Party shies away from much attention to lynching. Booker T. Washington himself speaks very little about lynching at the time, while he speaks out against the pogrom in Russia. And there's dozens of African-American newspapers at the time that I was able to review that raised this question without it congealing in any kind of institutional endeavor. This eventually happens because of the insights and work of a then very well-known radical couple. William Walling, William English Walling, is a very well-known independent radical. He writes the first major widely read book on Russian radicals, Russia's Message, which John Reed acknowledges in his famous book, 10 Days That Shook the World. As a he acknowledges his debt to William Walling's book. William Walling travels with and then eventually marries Anna Strunsky, I'm happy to say a Stanford graduate, fluent in Yiddish and Russian, who had been close, a very well-known Bay Area radical at the turn of the century, co-authored a book with Jack London, her one-time lover. And the two of them are in Russia for 2 years in the wake of the 1905 revolution and then return to the United States. Soon afterwards, there is a Springfield riot, anti-black riot in Illinois, which they both cover. And they become increasingly preoccupied with, if you will, the intersection between pogromist violence in Russia and lynching in the United States. And and then at a moment at Cooper Union in September, I think, 1908, they're on the stage of the Great Hall of the Cooper Union speaking about William Walling's new book on Russia. And it's Anna Strunsky who then draws the connection between pogroms and lynching, and suggests that lynching in the United States is an even greater evil. And there are a number of activists in the hall at the time. They stay up all night. It seems at the time in the Lower East Side or the East Village, people got very little sleep, and they and plans begin to be made for what becomes eventually the NAACP. It's called something else in 1908, and named the NAACP in 1909. Walling is its first chair or co-chair, and yeah. So the and just one more word about this, the arguments made by so many Russians about pogroms were eerily similar to the arguments made about lynching in the United States. Pogroms were blamed widely by Russians on Jews themselves, on their economic rapacity, on their radicalism. Here, typically, lynching was blamed on blacks, their sexual appetites, their economic competition. And so one could draw very potent similarities.
Let me broaden out a little bit. We don't have very much time left, so we'll have to be brief here. But over and over again, it seems that this pogrom captured the attention of so many people. And one thing that goes throughout your book is the fictionalization and also the emotional response of all these communities. The response of Chinese in, I believe, San Francisco. The response of
New York.
The response of the poet Bialik, who basically leaves out whole parts of the story to make it sound like nobody fought back. Noam Chomsky has his version of it. Netanyahu supporters have their own version of it. And there's something you did in the book that I found kind of unusual, which is that you drew not only on factual responses, but also you drew on fiction. You drew on a Philip Roth novel. You drew on Woody Allen in a movie. I just got this overwhelming feeling that this event that was quite terrible has become everybody's own personal version of what it means to suffer and be persecuted. And I was very interested in that aspect of it.
What I could say briefly is that one of the takeaways that I was able to take away from this book, and finishing it at a moment when fake news is suddenly ferociously in the air, and I started the book long before it became conceivable, the inconceivable became conceivable, our current inconceivable situation, is the power of fiction, the power of myth. Myth is far more coherent than nonfiction, and there aren't the rough edges that exist in news.
Better than real
news, it's immeasurably better than real.
So, like Bialik's poem, which is, I guess, taught in Israeli schools, leaves out whole parts of the hundreds of people who resisted. So that would be an example of the fiction being inspiring in a way where the original story may not have been.
And not only leaves it out, he himself recorded these events, as I pointed out,
notes.
In copious detail,
right,
in his notes that he didn't publish. And why he did that, I tried to wrestle with in the book. He was telling a part of the truth. But I think one of the takeaways that I was left with after finishing this book is how utterly crucial it is to scrutinize not only all the information that one receives, but the way in which one receives it. Because I'm looking at highly self-critical figures who nonetheless, who have access to a massively well-documented incident, and yet what's immeasurably more powerful, what sticks more resolutely, are the myths.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time. We both want to congratulate you on a terrific book. Again, our guest was Professor Steven Zipperstein of Stanford University, and we've been discussing his new book, Pogrom, Kishinev and the Tilt of History, which has just been published by Liverlight and is available everywhere, and we urge you to read it. Thanks again for joining our show.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much.
And once again, everyone, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. And thanks for joining us. We'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
Bye, everybody.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WuCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.